What a world we live in, huh? It is an amazing world. My wife currently sitting in the other room, having simultaneous video conferences with her sister in Arkansas, her other sister and her husband on the island of Mindanao, southern Philippines, and then also chatting with her niece, who's at school in Cagayan, which I mispronounced, I'm sure, also in on the southern island of Mindanao, all going on at the same time. It is an amazing world. And coming up, Daniel H. Wilson will add to it. Daniel earned a PhD from the Robotics Institute of Carnegie Mellon University, where he also received master's degrees in robotics and data mining. Data mining. He has worked in top research labs, including Microsoft Research, the Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, that's P-A-R-C, and Intel Research, Seattle. Daniel currently lives in a fully wired smart house. He is the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising, which I'm particularly interested in, as well as Where's My Jetpack, as well as a contributing editor to Popular Mechanics magazine. So lots to talk about coming up with Daniel H., Dr. Daniel H. Wilson in a moment. Dr. Wilson, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure to have you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm a really big fan of robotics, artificial intelligence, and such, and you're just the right guy for all of that.
Thanks.
Let's begin with AI. I'm very curious. By the way, I asked a guest a couple of weeks ago when we were on this topic, did you see that movie, Artificial Intelligence?
Yeah, sure. I really liked it, except for the second ending that they tacked on. It kind of went on for an extra 15 minutes, I think.
Yes, I thought the whole thing was really, really excellent. Is that in our future?
Yeah, I think a lot of that stuff is in our future. Although they, of course, are in the movie, they play around with some different possibilities. You know, they have Gigolo Joe, which is a robot that
yes.
satisfies, you know, carnal love. And then there's, of course, the little boy, David, who satisfies more of, a higher level sense of love. And there's a lot of indications that people do interact with humanoid robots the same way they interact with people, because they just the way that the robot looks, it provokes and invokes all of that natural built-in, all those natural built-in mechanisms for human interaction. And
it
there's
sure
no way
does.
To turn it off.
Yeah. Actually, in the movie, there was no way to turn it off. They had, I think, five key words or phrases that would then initiate the bonding between the boy and mom. And it was so good. Anyway, where in the world are we, in your estimation, with artificial intelligence? How are we going to even know when we get there?
Well, artificial intelligence is a huge field. And in any scientific endeavor, you try to nail down some really specific problem that you can solve. And you can say, okay, look, I did this. Now let's go to the next problem.
Yeah.
But AI is a really hard problem because in order to make a human-level intelligence, you have to solve the AI hard problem, which is you have to solve all of it. And that's really... It's tough to do the whole enchilada at once. So what we have right now is a lot of research in artificial intelligence for solving really specific problems. So it's not what most people think of when they think AI, but this is maybe, there are people who spend their entire careers working out vision algorithms so you can have a machine that can look at a scene and then say, that's a cat, that's a dog, you know, the cat is on top of the dog. or, you know, that's a human, he's running away. That kind of stuff. So in terms of getting general purpose artificial intelligence to a human level, I think that's one of the hardest problems in robotics. I think it's harder even than the mechanical problems of building a robot. And there's one surefire way to know when you've reached, you know, your goal, and that's if you have a robot that can pass what's called the Turing test.
So, Turing.
Alan Turing was a mathematician and a computer scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a test to determine whether or not you can tell whether you're interacting with a human level intelligence. And The really simple version that's not a full robotic version is you essentially go into a chat room with someone and you talk and you're allowed to write whatever you want to write. And if you can't tell the difference between, if you can't tell whether the person you're talking to is a human or a robot, then hey, you know,
well, then we're getting close. We're getting close because I say this because when I was in the Philippines, I spent 8 months there recently, and I forget, I had difficulty with something or another, and I did get into a chat program, and I'm telling you, doctor, I guess it went on for 10 or 15 minutes. Several times I asked, are you a human? I got no answer. Actually, I did get a response, but it wasn't a direct response to that. It did finally answer the question, say no, and said no. But for at least 10 minutes, maybe 15, I had no idea what I was talking to.
Yeah, well, that's, see, and again, this is where the robots can really excel, is you probably were there for a reason. You probably were trying to solve some kind of specific technical problem.
That's exactly right, yes.
And so whenever they're what's called really domain-specific, so if the robot is in an area, it can learn one area really, really well. And in fact, the types of systems that solve those sorts of problems, they can diagnose medical problems. They're called expert systems. And all they are is just huge collections of rules. And they actually outperform, generally, whenever they get very specific, they outperform humans. Even surgeons, even, you know, doctors with years and years of experience will they just don't have as you know, as big a hard drive.
Well, how do we make decisions? We're just nothing but a huge collection of rules, really, ourselves.
Yeah, well, so, you know, people think that the difference between the way the human brain works and the way a computer processor works is that the brain is just much more parallel. So it's got a lot of different processes happening at once. And there are a lot of artificial intelligence is really seeking to reproduce human intelligence. And so the researchers often draw inspiration from real brains. And I have lots of friends who are neuroscientists, you know, I couldn't do it. They have to kill cats, you know, like
Doctor,
that.
Is it a matter of processing speed or storage or both?
So I always find that it's really difficult to compare biological thinking with you know, silicon thinking, because you automatically have differences. For instance, you have a lot more storage space on a computer than you would have on a brain, and so there's no way to say what's the limitation. The limitation is really just how we use our resources, right? So we have lots of storage space. We have lots of speed, but we humans don't know how to program the computer. Our learning algorithms don't learn fast enough. They don't learn well enough to replicate our abilities.
Is there a way to actually speak to how much storage a human brain has?
So, yeah, you can do stuff like this. I think Ray Kurzweil gets into this a lot, and one way to do that, well, actually, so my advisor at Carnegie Mellon was really interested in something he called, and I could be getting this name wrong, but he called it the Cyber Baby Project. And the idea was, you know, a lot of the reason why these AI algorithms, why the chatbots, they don't really understand what you mean whenever you say ice cream or going to the park. You know, they don't have all those experiences. And so the idea is to put a camera on a baby, you know, from the baby's perspective, and microphone, and just record every single thing that happens for an entire lifetime. And then if you took that childhood and stored it on a hard drive, then you could ideally train an artificial intelligence algorithm to know everything that a human knows. And as it turns out, you can calculate how much data the eyeballs are collecting every second, if you think of it as video and a camera, and how much data your ears are collecting, how much data all your senses are collecting. Right. And then, as it turns out, it's not that much. If you run a video nonstop, it's a lot, but it's not infeasible even now to store that much data. Huh. So we are very finite. Everything we experience in our lives someday, soon, will fit, you know, on every experience.
Well, I know that processors certainly are increasing. I think still exponentially. Mm-hmm. I don't think that any laws have stopped. It's still doubling roughly 18 months or so every 18 months. Right?
I think Moore's law is still in effect. Yeah.
Right.
Intel just announced another some new approach that they've got to put more transistors in less space. So it looks like it's still going strong.
Moore himself expressed some doubt about whether his law was going to be around much longer, but apparently it's still going strong.
Yeah, it eventually, you know, has to end, but we'll see.
Well, maybe, and then maybe there'll be a big breakthrough of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, you know, more and more we're getting processors that are doing more and more parallel tasks. There's already, you just mentioned, plenty of storage. So at some point, we do arrive at something we would call artificial intelligence. And that point would be when you cannot distinguish a conversation you're having?
Well, so artificial intelligence is just a field of research. If you want to say, I guess you would call that general purpose human level intelligence, because so many people work on problems where they make really smart algorithms that learn really fast and do their job really well. So, for instance, every time you if you've got a newer model car, or at least not an ancient car, when you hit the brakes,
right?
If you've got an anti-lock brake system, you've more than likely got a neural network that's sitting in between you and the actual brakes. When you push down on the pedal, you're really just pushing a button, and the button tells a neural network, the human wants to slow the car down, and then it figures out how to slow the car down. Because honestly, as a human, you're not as good as it is at actually stopping your car. You'll wreck your car. The analog brakes will keep you from wrecking your car because it knows more about braking than you do. And it's learning all the time. And you know what? It's really good at that very specific problem. Could it talk to you? No. Is it in any way resemble human intelligence? Not really at all. But it is AI.
It is the crudest form, I suppose, of the beginning of AI. And it in future years, they expect to get to the point where cars will drive themselves and you'll be nothing but a passenger, right?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I wouldn't say that it's the crudest form of AI, because it gets much cruder.
Okay.
But we've already got unmanned ground vehicles. So these are called UGVs. And I don't know if you remember, out in Nevada, I think it was in 2005, they had the DARPA Grand Challenge.
Yes, and it didn't go that well, did it?
The first one did not go that well. The top car was actually from Carnegie Mellon, and it made it about 7 miles before it high-ended on a rock and broke an axle. The next year, after 12 months, I think at least 5 cars finished. They were actually passing each other. I think the head car, the winner, was from Stanford. I should mention that the guys behind the head car had just left Carnegie Mellon to go to Stanford, so a little school pride there.
Okay.
But anyway, Stanford beat us out. It was humiliating. And their car, it was just a modified Volkswagen Touareg. And the cars these days are so drive-by-wire, which they're just controlled by a computer that's sitting inside the car that can actually brake and accelerate and do all these other things as part of different safety features. The car could actually, they just tapped right into that. They just tapped right into the computer, and then they put a bunch of sensors on the car, and it went 130 miles in something, I forget, you know, like 10 hours or something like that, and had an average speed of 30 or 40. But this is over just rough terrain. There were cliffs. Really amazing. And next year, or actually later this year, they're kicking up the stakes, and now they're not going to be racing out in the empty desert. Where there, you know, no humans were allowed anywhere near these cars, right?
Sure, sure.
Who gets blamed, you know, when somebody gets hurt? This year, they're going to be doing it in a mock urban environment. So it's really clear, it's really obvious what DARPA is going for. And, you know, that is unmanned ground vehicles that can operate in crowded urban environments with following street signs, everything.
And I imagine DARPA imagines weapons of all kinds on these vehicles.
So actually, well, this is all really publicly available stuff. So it's called the Future Combat systems.
Yes.
And so if you look in there and you look and see what UGVs are called for, they're not primarily weapons platforms. One of them is a mobile ambulance that actually, so there's no place for a human to sit in these things. It makes them much more efficient. They can go further with less fuel. And so what this thing's supposed to do is go out on a battlefield, find a hurt soldier, open, a little door opens,
right,
and it drags the guy in there. And while the person is in this little, basically a mobile coffin, there are robotic arms that are being teleoperated by surgeons, back in the States. And so you have someone ideally doing surgery, whatever has to be done on this poor soldier, while he's getting taken out of danger.
Better to think of it as a mobile ambulance. Coffin is a little...
Yeah. I'm not gonna be the guy writing.
Remember Forbidden Planet, the movie?
Yes.
Okay. Robbie the robot and all
that? Yeah.
All right. When I was young, I went to see Forbidden Planet with my dad, and we all thought that by now, I'm beginning to get long in the tooth here, we'd have Robbie and more, but it didn't happen.
Yeah.
How come? What happened? What went wrong?
Well, so, the field of artificial intelligence, really, they thought they made some wild predictions early on, because they had some early successes. Some of the very first times that people tried their hands at AI, they were able to get some really great results. They had programs that could prove equations on their own. So that seems really smart. They
yes.
could play chess. They could beat a human at chess, right? This is a very, you have to be a real smart person to play chess, right? It's very cerebral. What they found out was that all this high-level thought, with a lot of, games where you have a lot of rules, or math where you have, again, a lot of rules. This is the natural domain for machines, just because you program them with rules. It's not natural for humans. That's why we think it's so hard.
It's a mechanical part of it, though, that didn't come through.
Yeah. So it's everything, essentially, it's everything a two-year-old can do is what was really hard. So recognizing shapes and colors, getting up and walking, learning how to walk after you fall down, learning to recognize speech, learning to recognize faces, social stuff, all that stuff, really, really hard. And as it turns out, if you look at the human brain, there's just huge areas of the brain that are devoted to all these things. There's the motor cortex, all the vision stuff up in the front,
We now, of course, have very good facial recognition software.
It's okay. It's not that great. They tried to, it's not general purpose, right? It's really good if you limit the domain. Again, so face recognition works really well if you, there's this program out there that will label all your photos, So you give it all your digital photos, and it goes through there and puts writes the name of everybody that's in the photo. So you can say, show me all the pictures of me and grandma,
Okay, I've got a really dumb question. Maybe you can answer this.
Okay.
The newer cameras, I bought a camera in the Philippines when I was there, and it's incredible. If there's a human in the frame when you're about to take the picture, it puts a little square around the human's face.
It's called a bounding box, yeah.
Yeah, how in the hell does it do that? I've been wondering about that since I bought that camera.
So, yeah, that's, what's really impressive is that's actually a pretty difficult task to find the face like that. And if it's on a camera, that means that they've taken that algorithm and they've put it on a chip. Anyway, it's actually not that hard. So it does feature recognition. It pulls out things that look like a mouth, things that look like eyes, things that look like, ears and chin, and all the major facial features. And then
Dr. Wilson, it does it too well. I mean, very, very well. Listen, we're at a break point. Hold on, Dr. Wilson. Yes, it's true. Even if it's way in the back and hardly any part of the picture, it picks out the face and puts a little square around it. That's astounding. We'll be right back. And I never really gave it a lot of thought until just now, but I was amazed. I bought that little camera. I think it was a Canon, perhaps a Canon, and the very latest, 10 point something megapixels, really hot stuff. And After I bought it, I realized it was picking out faces. Now, that's an interesting technology when you think about it. No matter where they move, where they are in the room, it finds the human face and puts a little box around it. Now, how does a camera know how to do that anyway? And I know that we talk too much about the possible weapons applications of technology, but if a camera can do that, imagine what a gun could do. And I suppose it could look at the face and decide if the face is the enemy or a friendly. I'm not sure how it would do that, but if it can do what it does now, it can probably do that, and then it can probably order the trigger to pull. And there's a terrible thought for you. We'll be right back. In the pressure of combat, Dr. Wilson, many friendlies are unfortunately killed. Friendly fire kills a lot of people. If a camera can decide where a human face is so well, and it does a great job of it, as I said, even if it's only a tiny, tiny part of the framed photograph, it still finds the human face and puts that little box around it. Then it seems to me, how big a step is it from that to, for example, deciding if that's a friend or foe and whether the gun should shoot?
Yeah, well, those are questions that are being asked right now by a lot of people. In fact, I'm just today actually read a document that came from the Naval Surface Warfare Center, and it is a basically... They're laying out, there's something called the laws of armed conflict, or the law of armed conflict, and this just says what you can and can't do. It's related to the rules of engagement and the discriminate use of force. And they're trying to figure out what to do with this when it comes to autonomous, autonomous, whatever they call them, weapons platforms, right?
Yes.
And so what the latest is, what I've just read, is that one way to get around this, because you cannot... Basically, it's agreed that you cannot have a machine that's going to not have a human in the loop. There always has to be a person welded to the machine that to give it the go ahead to actually use any lethal force. Because actually, discrimination is really that's a key part of law of armed conflict. Any weapon has to be able to discriminate. You have to be able to target what you're after. You can't just drop something that's going to kill everybody and have all this collateral damage.
Right.
That's a huge strike against it. So instead of, but what they're trying to get away from is actually having to have a person there all the time, because these things are obviously much more efficient if there's nobody, watching the trigger.
There you go.
So here's what they came up with, and I think this is really interesting to think about. Machines only attack machines, and humans kill humans. So this is the way they've got it set up, and they have this. They have a lot of precedents that they've laid out. There's something called a captor. It's a sub hunter, and what it does is it's basically a mine that sits on the bottom of the sea, and when a submarine comes by, an enemy submarine, it launches a torpedo. Mm-hmm. It's just like a mine that only kills submarines. There are other tank mines, things like that won't trigger for people, but they'll trigger for tanks. What's really interesting... So they're saying that this has already been done before. What's really interesting is the number one thing that they're concerned with is that the enemy will spoof a system designed to only attack machines, and they'll intentionally try to get it to kill people because it would be a very bad publicity for the machine, and obviously it would mean that the machine was used inappropriately, right?
It doesn't sound like the three laws are exactly in place.
Well, the three laws I think are a beautiful thing, and they're not in place. The machines are being used pretty much in whatever way they can. And I mean, for the record, sticking a gun onto a mobile robot is nothing new. And these, it's already happened. In fact, Samsung has a mobile gun. Actually, wait, it's not mobile. It's just a Sentry. So it's this gun with a camera on it. It's exactly it's very similar to the camera that you have. And what it can do is it's sitting along, South Korea bought a bunch of these things, and apparently they're deploying them along the demilitarized zone. And they're just going to sit there, and they watch, I think it's a 1.5 miles swath there, and they recognize people. And if people come too close, I assume it'll shoot at them.
Or will there be a human watching the camera making the decision to shoot?
That's up to South Korea.
So not necessarily.
Yeah, not necessarily. You know, in the United States, we, you know, we do have a lot of rules in place that, you know, and a lot of mechanisms for determining when the rules are broken as well.
Well, and, you know, I've had, when I do this kind of program in the past, Doctor, we you know, you get a lot of people writing saying it is so immoral, are sending out machines to do the killing for us. But then, of course, you get a quick rush of people saying, what are you talking about? Immoral? That's not immoral as compared to sending our young men and women out to do the job and dying in, day we get the news from Iraq, right?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, and so far in Iraq, there have been a lot of mobile robots that have saved lives by going out and tagging the improvised explosive devices, right? So instead of having a man walk over and kick a junk pile to see if there's a bomb in there,
right,
they'll send a robot. And, you know, I've actually, at conferences, met Marines who have used these things, and, you know, they're intense. Of course, you know, they're there to sell the particularly what I'm talking about is the Talon from Foster Miller. It's a really cruel-looking robot. It's black. It's really scary-looking. But apparently, it, you know, it does its job. And they get blown up, and they get repaired in the field all the time. But,
well, better the Talon than somebody's leg or worse.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, they're talking of, you know, they envision a lot of time, you know, this is not my area. All my research is in smart houses that take care of elderly occupants. Uh-huh. So, you know, this is way out of my league. But they do envision sort of this future where, you know, you have a gun that's, it's a robot gun, right? You're carrying it. It's got a face recognizer. It's got all that stuff. What it's really looking for, though, is not faces. It's really looking for other guns. And so when you pull the trigger, it's kind of like that movie Shane, you know, it shoots the gun out of the hand and like, and that's it. And I mean, that's kind of a compelling scenario to imagine. Probably it's way too optimistic to ever happen, but you know,
are you actually afraid that one day, in our future, and I don't know how far it is, maybe not as far as I might imagine, robots will rise up and make some sort of decision to, kill those that made them?
You know, no.
You don't believe that?
No, I don't. You know, the book is in the humor section, and you know, How to Survive a Robot Uprising. The thing is, I'm not personally afraid that a robot uprising is going to happen, but you know, you never can. You can't be too safe, you know. So, all the information that's in the, you know, it's all real. I mean, I didn't. I literally asked people. Can a humanoid robot be this, how tall, how big could it be? Could it be the size of, you know, like what you see in Star Wars? And it's really interesting to ask roboticists this kind of questions because they'll come back with real answers, you know. They'll work it out on a napkin and say.
Well, look, if we can imagine a situation where robots do rise up or do make a decision that is not in our best interest, then probably it can happen. Most of what we have imagined in the past seems as though it's happened.
Well, I think we tend to focus on the stuff that happens. You know, there's a lot of patting yourself on the back whenever another thing from Star Trek comes true.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say that just because we can imagine it, it's possible, although normally that's an optimistic thought.
And then there's a follow-up question here. I mean, all this indicates that you sort of did believe that, but apparently not. The single best tip to keep in mind when fighting a robot would be?
So if you're fighting a robot, the best tip is to go for the sensors, because when you're designing a robot, the sensors are always the most sensitive areas of the robot that are prone to error. So the things like cameras, you know, cameras are just, relative to the rest of a robot, they're just so delicate, you know.
So they're also going to be the best protected, though, aren't they? In other words, if you're building a robot and you know it's going to go into combat, then you're going to protect the most sensitive parts.
Yeah, that,
camera,
you know,
whatever.
That's true. In a robot uprising, which is what I consider, you're not necessarily fighting military robots. If it's a robot uprising, that means all the servant robots decide to come at you. You know, so now you're fighting your Roomba, right? But as it turns out, the sensors are the most delicate, and they also have the most constraints, because a lot of times they'll have to be, for instance, a camera has to be line of sight. It has to have, you can't put it behind a thick piece of steel. For instance, I actually worked for Northrop Grumman for a little while, which is a big military defense contractor, and we were working on an autonomous boat. So it's just an unmanned surface vehicle, a boat that drives itself. And we were not allowed to use any active sensors, so sensors that bounce signals off of other things, like a laser rangefinder or ultrasonic sensors, you know, operate the way bats echolocate, because that gives away your location immediately. And so it was much harder to design this thing without
any... Then what do you use for sensors, then, if you can't do that?
Well, you use passive sensors like cameras and microphones, but you can't use any active illumination with your cameras. So, you know, you might actually just have a spotlight next to a camera normally, for visible light, or you might have an IR light source, you know, with an IR camera.
Sure.
So yeah, just cameras and microphones. It's pretty much what we had to deal with, which makes it pretty tough at night.
And you did it?
Well, yeah, we got it out there. It was very docile for a military robot. It was called the Rowboat. And it got out there and it tootled around, and it had GPS as well. Yeah, it had some, and of course an IMU and some things like that, just so it could figure out what its orientation was. And yeah, there were a lot of really confused people on the river out there. It was in Pittsburgh, the Three Rivers area. You jump them out there, and it was really clear that there was no one driving that boat.
Wow. How long might it be, Doctor, before we actually do have servant level robots?
You know, the question is whether we want them. You know, it doesn't really seem like Americans want it as bad as the Japanese and the Koreans. They so if you look at the pace of humanoid robotics research in Japan, they're really focusing on humanoid robots that are going to be servants. They are definitely going to go into your home. They're going to pick up all your tools. They're going to use your broom. They're going to wash your dishes. Just a total general purpose servant. And that's a long ways off. It's a really optimistic goal to reach.
Well, why do you think Americans, as opposed to the Japanese, are not as interested?
You know, I'm not sure. I think instead of looking at why Americans are not interested, I think first it pays to look at why the Japanese are.
Okay.
So interested, and I think part of that is their culture, obviously, and some religion. There's a really good book on this called Loving the Machine, which is all about why the Japanese love robots. Part of it has to do with Shintoism, which is a religion that associates sort of a life force with every inanimate object, including robots. And so they think of them naturally as something that's alive, and so they forgive them for not maybe performing up to a standard that makes it worth the money to buy them.
I'll be darned.
You know, and I found that the United States, we're doing a lot of work on humanoid robotics, don't get me wrong. Part of the reason why the United States, Western Europe, and Japan are really interested in humanoid robots that are going to be in our houses helping us out is because in the States, all the baby boomers are going to retire, or starting to. And in Japan and Western Europe, they're also noticing that the population, the demographic, is skewing so that there are a lot more retired people than there are workers. There's nobody to take care of everybody that's retiring. And the robots are literally the only caretakers that a lot of people are going to be able to have.
Are they going to be that good that soon? Are the Japanese going to be able to come up with a robot that is going to be sufficient for those needs?
Well, see, the Japanese are going for the whole thing all at once. And in the States, we tend to compartmentalize all the problems and try to solve them separately. Now, here's a thought-provoking idea that I just heard. I just interviewed this guy a week ago for a Popular Mechanics article. And he's a humanoid robotics guy, and his name's Trevor Blackwell, and he's running a place called AnyBots, Inc. And he's got a really impressive pneumatically powered humanoid, but it's got no brain. You know, it's got no intelligence. And I was asking him, what's his vision? You know, he says he wants to build a humanoid robot servants that are going to go into the homes. His vision, outsource the intelligence to a human being in another country. So you've got a robot. Now, this is thought-provoking. This honestly scares the bejesus out of me.
well, yes.
You know, in my own research, I have, my research is all about putting sensors into people's houses, and the sensors connect to an AI, and the AI basically figures out what your patterns are, and then it looks for functional decline. Like, all the, most of the women in my family are nurses. My mom's a case manager. She's a nurse that visits people in their homes and makes sure that they're able to do what they can, that they can perform all their activities of daily living. If they can't, she gets someone in there that helps them out. And that's what this computer does. I can't use cameras.
You know, it's hitting me what you're saying. So some guy in India somewhere will be sitting in front of a monitor deciding how to direct this robot to do what you want.
Well, no, he'll now, depending on how complicated the robot is, he may, the guy in India may have his hands in gloves so that he can teleoperate the robot's arms and hands. So that he can do something like dexterous manipulation is really tough for things that are slippery or things that are deformable. So,
right.
So washing dishes is pretty tough. There's a robot that can do it, but it has to have specially colored dishes, and it uses plastic dishes for obvious reasons. But, you know, why do all the research? Why not just have a guy put his hands in some gloves and let a human do it, you know? So so this is the idea at AnyBots. The problem is that there are human eyes behind you know, the robot cameras, and that's right. Kind of scary.
It is.
That's part of the good stuff of a robot, is that you know there's nothing going on there, you know? It's like, so my cat saw me get out of the shower. Who cares?
That's right.
Now, you know, when there's a robot in the house and it's, you know, that could be scary.
It could be scary with some guy in India controlling. My God, that one hit me pretty hard. I just thought about it and I don't want one.
Well, so what I found in my research, which I was, you know, I will talk about my research all day, so feel free to tell me to shut up about it.
All right.
So what I found in my research was that I could not use cameras to, you know, there's this. What I found basically was that if you're going to invade somebody's privacy, there has to be a huge perceived benefit. There has to be, you're really doing something that's crucial, because nobody wants to give up their privacy for nothing, you know? And I totally agree and understand that. That's why, you know, that's why these people let my mom come into their house and ask how they're doing.
Maybe if you were bedridden, completely bedridden, you might make that level of decision.
To bring in a, well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of ways, I think, to depersonalize it. You could make the robot stay in certain areas. It wouldn't probably be one person controlling the robot. They would probably trade off in shifts so that the robot could be active 24 hours a day.
That doesn't help me.
Well, you know, yeah, it'll be, I'm very interested to see if this will take off, because, you know, different people are comfortable with different levels of technology.
It might take off. I mean, just your having said this opens up so many possibilities. Oh, my God. You know, the labor force over there is so inexpensive that I'm really afraid it makes sense.
Well, this does make sense if you actually turn this equation upside down. There's something called Robonaut, which is a NASA humanoid. It's actually a human almost exactly from the waist up. It's got the same number of joints, the same number of everything that a person has. And what that means is when you control it, there's a one-to-one mapping. And so Robonaut has been used by highly specialized experts to do research, you know, to teleoperate research instead of having someone.
Doctor, hold tight. We're at a break point, and I've got to think about this outsourced intelligence for robots in your home. What do you say, folks? I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.